From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You have either read his books or seen the movies, The Third Man, Brighton Rock, Our Man in Havana, The Quiet American. Graham Greene was one of the 20th century's most widely read, talented, and secretive writers. His dark, globe-trotting adventures, complex Catholicism, and wartime work as a spy for British intelligence were all echoed in his writing. He was a giant of a man, drawn to the damned, George Orwell once said. And chronicling his giant life was the task taken on by my guest tonight, acclaimed biographer Norman Sherry. Sherry began his epic undertaking in the mid-70s. Now, 27 years later, after following Greene's footsteps around the world, Norman Sherry has finally finished the third and final volume of The Life of Graham Greene. Norman, I shall be alive for volume one of your biography, Greene once told him, but I shall die before volume two, and you, my dear Norman, will not live to see completion of volume three. He was almost right. Greene died in 1991, but Sherry did finish volume three, the keystone in a life of espionage, violence, betrayal, sex, doubt, and remarkable literature. Tomorrow is the 100th anniversary of Graham Greene's birth. This hour we'll dive into the life of the writer, the roamer, the man. Tonight on Point, biographer Norman Sherry and the life of Graham Greene. Joining me now from New York is Norman Sherry, distinguished professor of literature at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He is author of the three-volume biography, The Life of Graham Greene. Norman Sherry, thanks for joining us.
Jolly good. I'm here.
Wonderful to have you. 27 years is a very long time. How did you spend 27 years writing three volumes?
The very first time that Graham spoke about this, he addressed me with my rank, and I addressed him by saying, Mr. Greene. He said, Professor Sherry, how long do you think it'll take? I didn't know of him, really. And I said, 3 years. He said, 3 years. I said, then 5 years. He said, 5 years. It'll take you 20 and then some. He was right. I was wrong.
You are... How old are you now, Norman Sherry?
Damned old.
Damned old. This has been the greater part of your life. You'd already spent 10 years writing the biography of Joseph Conrad. Did Graham Greene take over your life? Did he inhabit your life?
Yes. And I now have two American chickadees, as I call them, children. And one is 10, and the other's now 13. They have seen less of me, than much less than they would have done if I did not have this enormous task. I wanted it over because I longed to be with my children. I often could not be. This man consumed me, but then he was worth being in turn consumed in a three-volume biography because he was utterly incredible.
He's written up, considered by great figures in literature as something extraordinary, by I guess all his readers. William Golding said he was the ultimate 20th century chronicler of consciousness and anxiety. You heard we referenced George Orwell before, saying that Graham Greene found something rather distinguished in being damned. Hell is a sort of high-class nightclub. Did you see Graham Greene in a kind of fascination with the damned in his own life?
I think he thought he was damned, and that's what troubled him near the end of his life. There's a fable in a novel of his called The Burnt-Out Case, of which at that time Graham Greene had become almost a burnt-out case. And in it, he tells a fable of a famous jeweler. But if you replace novelist with jeweler, you will discover that he's talking about himself. And it's a most extraordinary fable. Basically, after incredible success and never failing at anything he ever tried, he comes to feel, the jeweler, but that's to say Graham Greene, really the novelist, he comes to feel that he is doomed, and that God has decided not to punish him in life, but will punish him in death. And he's deeply and profoundly afraid. And that's why he made such a friend of a certain Spanish priest who finally came to him when he was dying. He needed that. He needed to be cleared of danger. We do not know whether or not God did punish him. Making love to women was his great secret. There are thousands of casualties, if you can speak of it like that. Most men wouldn't, and nor should I, really. But he was a man of excessive sexual prowess, and he had the most unusual eyes that almost any woman would fall in love with at once.
You've described his eyes as like a Siberian husky's, very, very, very pale blue.
Yes, I'd never seen eyes like them, and though he was always extraordinarily cordial to me, and though he allowed me to write in any way I wished, his last words before he died, and he was dying then when he spoke to me, only had a few days left, he said, "Norman, I want you to understand the truth. If it's for me that you write, that's fine. If it's against me that you write, that's fine. The truth, Norman, else I'll haunt you." And he meant it. But he hasn't haunted me yet, but of course there's always time for that.
You referred to this just now, but I wonder. He was devoutly a Catholic, but also a tortured Catholic. You spent 27 years going around the world and going deep into the details of his life, his papers, his letters. This was an authorized biography. In Christian terms, did Graham Greene go off with grounds to be damned?
He felt that twice he had lived, in each case, two very beautiful ladies, both of them married. In the case of the last one, who has died not so long ago now, her husband did not know what was going on. He didn't, in fact, live in the south of France. He was working elsewhere. And that troubled him very much, that he was publicly cheating. In the first one, that was Lady Walston, or Catherine Walston, mm-hmm. as she was, an American girl. And he loved her, I think, more than he could love anyone. But her husband allowed it to happen on the grounds, he said, that she has a mind of her own, and if this is what she wishes to do, this is what she can do.
But Graham Greene shocked even his mistress. She challenged him, you report, about rumors that he frequented prostitutes. And how did he respond?
He gave her a list, and that list is now in the book, with some of the strangest titles you ever could possibly consider.
And there are 47 names
47.
On that list of prostitutes.
But he was only young then, you see. Later on, that went on for a lifetime.
And we won't tell them all, but it's along the lines of Russian boots, Bond Street French, black pants,
right.
And so on. Bishop Hooper, I don't know what that one would mean.
No, I don't either.
So much of Graham Greene's body of work, so much made it onto the screen. I want to get a flavor of that in this hour while we talk with Norman Sherry, author of now the third and final volume of The Life of Graham Greene. Here from 1949, The Third Man, classic starring Joseph Cotten and the great Orson Welles, directed by Carol Reed, a murder mystery set in post-World War II Vienna. In this scene, Cotten confronts Welles, a man he thought was dead, on Wells' racket running illegal doses of bogus penicillin on the black market.
Old man, you never should have gone to the police, you know. You ought to leave this thing alone.
Have you ever seen any of your victims?
You know, I never feel comfortable on these sort of things. Victims? Don't be melodramatic.
Look down there. Would you really feel any pity if one of those dots stopped moving forever? If I offered you £20,000 for every dot that stopped, would you really, old man, tell me to keep my money? Or would you calculate how many dots you could afford to spend? Free of income tax, old man. Free of income tax. The only way you can save money nowadays.
A lot of good your money will do you in jail.
That jail's in another zone. There's no proof against me. Besides you.
I should be pretty easy to get rid of.
Pretty easy.
Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles there in the famous Ferris wheel scene above Vienna in The Third Man, 1949, and flirting with damnation themselves right there. There was a time when Graham Greene thought he had nothing to write, Norman Sherry. He ended up writing so much. What was the engine that drove him?
He wanted to be, but he never thought he was, perhaps the greatest novelist of our century. I believe he was that, unquestionably.
Make the case. That's a large claim in a century full of novelists. How do you make the case for Graham Greene as perhaps preeminent?
I think I would advise you to read, say, The Power and the Glory. Mm. It's a masterpiece. And when the priest picked up because he's drinking brandy and shouldn't be drinking brandy, and of course they jailed you for that in Via Hermosa. I followed in his footsteps there. The place is crowded with Catholics who are in jail.
This is, of course, Mexico. The book came out in 1939 after Graham Greene's trip to Mexico
right.
and had seen what he
right.
thought was persecution of, of Catholics.
Yes, unquestionably. You should, if you look at this the first volume, you'll see that there are two priests being shot.
Mm-hmm.
One of them hanged. He's looking at his church, and a notice is nailed to his knees saying, "This priest is killed because he was a priest." They killed every priest they could find. The one priest they couldn't find was the whiskey priest. And he was picked up and put into jail, but they didn't even know because he got thin and worn out. And so they didn't kill him then, though they ultimately did. And I tracked down, when I went there 40 years later, the original whiskey priest. He lived for 10 years, traveling, passing his judgment, helping the poor. And then they caught him, and then they shot him. And because he was so liked, not because he was a whiskey priest, but because he was the only priest in the area who stayed in that kind of dangerous situation, the others ran away or married. This situation for him, what happened to the real one, in the book, of course, he's shot.
Mm.
In reality, he was killed and then fed to wild pigs. So that way, he would not have a burial place, and no one could worship him in any sort of way.
Is it that closeness to violence and betrayal and darkness and damnation that, to your mind, puts Graham Greene in the spot as the greatest novelist of that century?
No, it's my opinion that he's the greatest, because some of the scenes are extraordinarily moving and highly intelligent, yet he writes with great immaculate ability. Very forward, very straight, some wonderful imagery. And at the end of it, let's say at the heart of the matter, at the end of that, you cannot help but be moved at the self-murder of the leading character who commits suicide. There's no one like Greene. There won't be, there can't be, special people. I don't mean there wasn't all sorts of things wrong with them. No genius goes there without having weaknesses. And I would not have spent that time, I could not have spent that time, if I hadn't been entirely fascinated by this man. I may tell you on one occasion, this I learned only after his death, on one occasion, someone visited me in Anacapri, where he had a special home where you'd write.
Mm.
It was late at night, it was 12 midnight. I'd gone to bed, I'd gone naked, because the damn place was hot for me, and I came from the north of England.
Sure.
And so there I was lying, and suddenly some fellow opened the bedroom door and closed it at once, seeing me asleep. And I dashed out after him, and I went out, and I could see somebody closing the front door. I went out, it was a moonlit night. It was strange to have the moon upon you when you're completely naked, but you're chasing someone. I had to find out who it was who was trying to get into this house. And then the front gate closed. You had to step up in order to get through that. This was a practiced person, able to do it easily. And when I got there, he had disappeared. That next day, I went to see Countess Cherio, who lived there and
yes.
who knew everybody and certainly knew Graham intimately. And I said, "Was it Graham Greene?" Because he was tall and thin as Graham Greene was at that time, though he put on weight later. And she said, no, Graham Greene has not been here. When Graham died, she met me again at the funeral in Switzerland, and she took me to her car, and she said, "Norman, I've got something to tell you. I've kept this a secret, because Graham told me not to tell anyone. It was Graham Greene. He felt that since you were his doppelganger, going everywhere in the world, he had a right to be your doppelganger and follow you." And
there.
That's what he was trying to do.
Norman Cherry, hold the thought. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with the biographer of Graham Greene, Norman Cherry. He's just come out with the final in the great three-volume biography. It's The Life of Graham Greene. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the life and work of novelist Graham Greene. My guest is the acclaimed biographer Norman Sherry, author of The Life of Graham Greene in 3 volumes. Let's listen to a little of the 2002 movie adaptation of Greene's 1955 novel, The Quiet American, a political thriller set in 1950s Vietnam. Here, Michael Caine narrates the opening of the movie.
I can't say what made me fall in love with Vietnam. That a woman's voice can drug you. That everything is so intense. The colors, the taste, even the rain. Nothing like the filthy rain in London. They say whatever you're looking for, you will find here. They say you come to Vietnam and you understand a lot in a few minutes. But the rest has got to be lived. The smell, that's the first thing that hits you. Promising everything in exchange for your soul. And the heat. Your shirt is straightaway a rag. You can hardly remember your name or what you came to escape from.
The Quiet American, 2002 adaptation of Graham Greene's great novel there, starring Michael Caine. Of course, he's the British journalist in Vietnam narrating the opening of that movie. Norman Sherry is with me, author of the 3-volume biography of Graham Greene, The Life of Graham Greene. Norman Sherry, I wish you'd take us into Graham Greene's World War II years in espionage, and how that morphed into the peripatetic lifestyle that he had later, traveling all the rest of his life and making so many books out of it. What was his spying role, and how did it turn into this later role?
Well, of course, he was writing long before he became a spy. That only happened during the war. First thing he did during the war was to be in the Blitz, and that Blitz went on for, I think, was it 76 days or 67 days? And nights, and he was right in the center of that. He had courage which was utterly extraordinary. But you see, you have to understand, he did not mind if he died. That's very different. He was never a cornered rat, even when he was dying. He wanted to die. So, of course, he went towards danger. And he wanted love, and he got great love. I'll come back to that in a moment. I'll deal with it now. But the fact of the matter is that he went to, he went abroad to Sierra Leone, and that was a country that he knew a bit because he had walked through it when he was just a youngster. It was a very dangerous place. When I went there, I got gangrene of the intestine, and I became very sick.
He was sent there by the British Intelligence Service then during the war.
He was sent there by the British Intelligence, by MI6.
And he was already a very, very well-known novelist, very accomplished novelist, of course, by the time of the war.
Oh, yes, because he had published Power and the Glory in 1940 anyway. That was the beginning of the war, pretty much. Mm-hmm. But he wanted danger. Instead of just going into the army, that's dangerous enough, or the Air Force or whatever, his sister was already in espionage. His sister Elizabeth, I dedicated the first book to her. She was just a tremendous person, highly intelligent, like all the Greens that I met. Those three that I can think of, those four, Sir Hugh Greene, the chap who became the director general at BBC. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Dennis, who became his private secretary, because, you see, he was such a man for keeping secrets, all secrets. Incredibly, he should let me loose on himself. When he knew that I'd go to endless trouble as a result of what I'd done in looking at Joseph Conrad, the first thing I did when I went out there in Singapore was to start studying 22,000 newspapers. All I was looking for was the source of a plot in one of Conrad's works.
So Graham Greene knew when he asked you to be his biographer that all of his secrets, or many of them, would be revealed, even if it took a long time.
Why he did that, I don't know. Because he wanted to be secretive. Though he did say to me, I will not tell journalists things, but I have to tell you. All right, he had to tell me. He did not tell me everything. Sometimes the works cost me, you can't imagine. Look, let me just give you a single example. He started committing suicide, trying to commit suicide when he was 13. I got to know a great deal about that. He said to me, don't forget, he said, I will not lie to you, I will not answer every question. And he said, I will not talk about that. He said, I've written about it anyway. I said, yes, but you've written about it deliberately in a way that tells you so little. Mm. I'm not going to answer that question. So I said, you just put 3 years onto the book, Mr. Green, because I now have to track down, you're 70, as many youngsters that were at school with you to try to find out about what really happened.
About a teenage suicide attempts. Later in That's the war, right. he worked under Kim Philby in the counterintelligence unit there. Of course, Kim Philby, who later took off of the USSR yes. And went turncoat. And he maintained a friendship with Philby. What about Graham Greene's espionage role after the war? Was there one?
Yes. I don't know what it did. I mean, wherever he went to a country, say, let's say Cuba, and he was very friendly with Castro, the Foreign Office, the FO, as it was called then, would come and see him. They would meet for dinner, and they would talk. And I know this because I've got records that prove the kind of questions that they wanted to know, wanted to have. When he went to China, it was the same thing, all sorts of questions. After all, the chap there, Mao Zedong, hadn't been in charge very long, and lots of priests had been booted out, and he was asked by the Foreign Office to keep a record. He kept a record. He's brilliant at keeping records. Nothing passed this chap's eyes. I mean, I was with him one day, moving from Tunbridge Wells. I was going to get onto a train with him and go into London. The first thing he did was to tell me that his wife was going to write about his marriage, and that was many years ago, and in other words, about his affairs. And he was so disturbed, and he suddenly started singing, this old man of 70, he suddenly started singing an old music hall song. And this is how it went. He said, shovel the dust on the old man's coffin and pick up your pen and write. Silent he was. There was nobody else, just him. And he was singing this song. And the look of absolute sorrow on this man's face, I'd never seen the like of it.
Do you mean the sorrow that his many, many infidelities would be exposed? As simple as that?
Yes, and of course I exposed them. He didn't seem to mind then, because he assumed he would be dead by the time it was all over. And of course he was right about that. It wasn't that he controlled me, though. Everyone thought he might be controlling me. He was not allowed to do that. That was the agreement we came to. I could go where I liked. I could travel where I liked. He wanted me to travel. Wanted me to see what kind of danger he had been in, I suspect. Wanted me to see just how he put novels together. And I really did look over his shoulder, as it were. Because if you, when you get to know a great deal, you can see exactly what's going on. Be a great writer. This is why I think he's a great writer. I watched him. I've seen all these things.
In retrospect, You paid dearly for following in Graham Greene's footsteps. As you said, you had gangrene of the intestine in Panama and tropical diabetes in Liberia. Lost some of your hearing there from a revolver being poked into your ear and detained in Haiti and on and on. When you first met Graham Greene in 1974 there at the Seville, his club in London, as you report, he said to you, and he was speaking more or less of you, he said, I don't like intellectuals. I don't like academics. Yes, they're interesting from the Adam's apple upwards, but they don't wear pants. Did you succeed in proving to Graham Greene in following his circuitous, dark path around the world that you wore pants, or was he always laughing in the dark, Norman Sherry?
He was laughing in the dark. That's a good phrase for him. I did not tell him about my own life. It was surprising. Somebody came along not so long ago, about 3 years ago now, and wanted to know if they could do my biography. I said, sorry, my secrets are my own secrets. I don't quite feel like that now, but I did then. And so no, he didn't seek to know my life, though he once did do a kind of third degree on me, just let me know how tough it was at being constantly interviewed. He got Elizabeth Dennis's husband to start asking me questions, and then he came in with his, and then another one, and another one, and another one. And I tried to field them as best as I could and honestly answer them as best I could. No lying. And then at the end he said, let's stop. Let's give Norman a full glass of the best scotch we've got. He deserves it.
Congratulations there to you. In the way Graham Greene held up all these things that were dark and difficult, Evelyn Waugh writes about him as a storyteller of genius, but focused on the underworld of gossip, spying, bribery, violence, betrayal. How did you ultimately, how have you come to understand what that was about? Was he holding these things up for humans to look at and say, oh, how wretched we are? Was he holding them up, this very Catholic man, was he holding them up to God as a kind of a rebuke or complaint? How do you understand that, Norman Cherry?
One of the things about Greene, and it carries on right through his life as a writer, is he's interested in, of course, intrigue, but he's also interested in who are the people who betray. He's interested in the Judas figure. And the Judas figure comes from the fact that as a youngster, he felt he was being persecuted. Don't forget his father was headmaster, and therefore a person who could be thought to be a spy.
At a boarding school for boys.
Mm-hmm. That's right, a boarding school purely for boys. And he wasn't good at games in those days. He seemed to show no courage. He seemed to be dark and frightened and troubled and suicidal. And he became more suicidal at that time because of all these things. And because one of his friends betrayed him and took his private diary, which had poetry in it and all sorts of things. And, of course, you're a lily-livered child and girl when you did things like that at a boys' school, where what mattered was that you could play games well, and he couldn't do any of those things. And he was betrayed, and it was handed on, this so-called friend of his handed it on to someone who then spoke about it publicly, talking about him, poor little thing, etc., 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 you know. And that's when he started trying to commit suicide.
So those betrayals of his very young life, you see working all the way through?
Oh, absolutely. It doesn't stop. He's for the victim, but he makes this wonderful point. I'm for the victim, but victims change. And of course, in my view, not necessarily his, if you think of Castro as a young man up in the mountains fighting, seemed to be totally heroic. Everyone seemed initially to love him. But then he started putting people to death very easily. So he becomes, was the victim, but becomes the victimizer. And that so often happens. And this fascinated Greene to watch that process. He had a great material to watch a human being, a Judas figure, come into being.
He's for the victim, and that comes through again and again, But what about redemption? Redemption doesn't seem so present. I mean, very few unambiguously sort of happy endings in his book, maybe in The Confidential Agent, but almost alone, it seems to me. Was redemption a possibility in Graham Greene's mind, in his novels?
For other people, he thought he might not be redeemed. He was very worried about the end. Very, very disturbed. Because he had gone after married women all the time, and that troubled him very deeply, though some of the most beautiful love poems in existence come from Graham Greene, when he was deeply and profoundly in love. So there's the two sides of him, a man who was constantly witnessing betrayal, and that's powerful in all his novels. But some of the love poems and some of the love scenes are suddenly, I mean, totally beautiful. You want me to quote something?
Yes, if you can.
Okay, I'll try to. He says in one case, this is to Catherine Walston, stunningly beautiful lady, if you want to look at how she looked.
And an affair of decades with her.
Yes. Yes. This is about 1,200, 300 letters he wrote to her. Here's one. I can't get you out of my heart. You are splintered inside it. And the surgeons are useless. They say one day I shall die of the splinter, but it cannot be removed. He loved her, he really did. And an example of this, may I read one more? Just one more?
Yes, yes, please.
Okay, here we go. This is how he met her, and this is what he's doing, and of course God comes into it. In a plane, your hair was blown This is how he suddenly fell in love with her, Catherine. And in an island, the old car lingered from inn to inn, like a fly on a map. A mattress was spread on the cottage floor, and a door closed on a world. But another door opened, and I was far from the old world sadly known, where the fruitless seeds were sown. And they called that virtue and this sin? Did I ever love God before I knew that place I rest in now, with my hands set in stone, never to move? For this is love, and this I love, and even my God is here. So God is here even in his sin. That's Graham Greene.
Norman Sherry, you write about his fear of damnation growing out of those affairs with married women, but he was married himself for almost all this time. What about that as a source of fear for his soul?
True. And you know that wonderful lady, I knew her all my life, really, and rang her up when she was 99, Vivian Greene. And I asked her to, come on, lassie, I said, you've just got one great year to go. Do it. And she said, I'm sorry, Norman, I'm very tired. I'll try, but I'm very tired. She didn't reach that. But 99 years
not
would
bad.
Be a pretty good thing for all of us to have.
But not with a faithful husband in the great book of those years.
No, I'm afraid not. And of course, he left her. And he describes that in one scene, one brilliant scene. And she comes into many of the novels. She's rather, you know, a nuisance because she's there. And he loved her intensely to begin with. But it didn't last. I suspect one of the reasons why he went with prostitutes was because she wanted a brother and sister relationship. And that was no good for him. That's why he had to go out. And he placed her on a pedestal, but he still had to go out to a prostitute. And did so.
You say he liked to do that precisely because there was no relationship there. On the mantelpiece.
I think, yes. That's what he liked, certainly, because then he had no responsibility. And he took his responsibilities very, very seriously. A man who would receive sometimes a mail of 50 letters per day and would reply to every one of them before he could begin writing.
That could get in the way of an author's work, but it doesn't appear to have. Norman Sherry, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the life of Graham Greene, third volume in a three-volume biography of the great 20th century novelist by Norman Sherry. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with biographer Norman Sherry, his new and third volume in a three-volume biography of Graham Greene. The life of Graham Greene has just come out, 27 years in the making. Let's listen to just a little bit from the film adaptation of Graham Greene's Our Man in Havana from 1959. Of course, a satire on espionage, intelligence, pre-Castro Cuba. In this scene, Jim Wormald, played by Alec Guinness, a hapless vacuum cleaner salesman in Havana, is recruited by the British spy Hawthorne, Noel Coward, to work for British intelligence in Cuba.
Come in. Just keep the water running. Looks more natural if someone barges in. And, of course, it confuses a mic.
A mic?
You're quite right to question it. Probably wouldn't be a mic in a place like this. But it's the drill that counts. Just ship that box, will you? No wires? Good. My name's Hawthorne. You will come to know me better as 59200. I'm in charge of the Caribbean Network.
It sounds like the Secret Service.
So the novelists call it.
Why have you picked on me?
Patriotic Englishman. Volunteered, 1939. We have to have our man in Havana. Recruit sub-agents, keep an eye on things. Submarines need fuel.
Atomic submarines don't.
Quite right, old man, but a war started with behind the dam. We also need economic intelligence. Sugar, coffee, tobacco.
It's all in the government yearbooks.
Oh, never rely on them.
When was they here?
Look out, someone's coming. Slip into a cabin. Mustn't be seen together.
We have been seen together.
Don't argue, old man. I know the ropes.
Alec Guinness and Noel Coward there in the 1959 Our Man in Havana from Graham Greene's work. He was blackballed, as you've, of course, written, by the Nobel Prize Committee, at least in your telling, Norman Cherry. How did that happen?
Well, I don't think he was blackballed. I just think that certain people in Sweden disliked his work. They thought it was too popular. That was one reason. They thought, because he was so friendly with a very famous actress whom I met, and she was a very beautiful lady.
The Swedish actress?
Yes, Anita Bjork. Mm-hmm. And Anita now is quite old. She telephoned me the other week, and I said, Anita, how can you be 18 already? And she said, I'm not 80, I'm 81.
Greater than you know.
A very beautiful lady, I thought. And everyone was jealous of Graham that he knew such a beautiful lady.
Did he think that he should be considered in the kind of Nobel Prize-winning rank for literature, that he should be seen in that serious literary way? Was it an annoyance or worse to him that he wasn't, that he was seen as more popular than that?
He said it didn't matter, but it mattered to him enormously because he was in for it almost every year and was failed to do it. One of the things wrong with him was a person who reviewed his first play in Sweden hated and detested it, said that, you know, he was letting the Catholics win and he believed that a Freud and only Freud was any good and that Graham Greene was making fun of people like Freud. That's a nonsense. It's a nonsense because, in fact, Graham Greene knew a great deal about such matters. But the fact of the matter, he came to this conclusion and he ended his discussion of that play and said there should be a plague flag above this playhouse. And you can see he hated him, and he got on the committee. He was a very important member of the committee. Yeah. And he said, over my dead body, it'll never be Green that gets through. And in fact, he outlived Graham Greene and then died a few months later when there's no longer any need to fight, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah. Graham Greene converted to Catholicism when he was, 21, 22 years old?
Yes, yes.
You describe him at his life's end fearing the judgment of God, I guess, because of his sexual indiscretions, but what about his dark view of human life itself? Did that make him fear a divine judgment?
I think he feared it because of his life, and he saw his life as being that of a man who was tremendously successful, but who had done things that he ought never to have done. And it got worse as he got older. But, you know, he was a persistent sort of chap. He wouldn't leave the very married woman, Yvonne Cloetta, would not leave her, even though he felt so guilty over it. And then that's why he thought he'd be punished by God. And if it had not been the priest that admired him enormously, a Spanish priest who followed him on trips all through northern Spain to a Trappist monastery there, he would have felt that he had no possibility of living. I can only tell you that I was immensely surprised when I looked at this fine old man. He seems an old man to me then, you see, at 70. And I thought, oh, what a nice old man. And I said, why did you take to writing? Oh, it didn't seem to be anything else to do. Why are you a Catholic? Oh, I don't know, it just happened. You know, it didn't tell me any truths in those days. Mm. But when I looked at his face from the side view, as I was going off to get him a drink, of black and tan, in fact, you know, black and tan Guinness and Bass. Mm. And I could see that the whole face was tightened in. And he had the tiniest little odd blue-veined nose through drinking, no doubt. But his mouth was tight. And I thought, this man will give me nothing.
But he did. He gave you 27 years' worth of work, and by the time you finished that, you were nearly 70 yourself, Norman Cherry. You describe Graham Greene and your work on his biography as making you maybe yourself afraid in a Graham Greenish way of death and mortality.
I've always thought about it. I've always believed that it would come too soon, and Graham Greene frightened me to thinking that it would. And when he said that, when I heard of it, not from him but from a well-known journalist, I did honestly believe that he could actually be right, since he was so often right. And I was afraid of that man.
Of premature death.
Yes. In my opinion, poor Vivian dying at 99 is too early. It's the only thing we know on Earth. I wish we could live it without death.
Norman Cherry, I want to thank you for being with us. It's been fascinating talking with you.
It's been fascinating listening to you and the conversation we've had. I thank you, my dear chap.
Norman Cherry, author of The Life of Graham Greene, third volume out after 27 years. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
You cannot lead if you send mixed messages. Mixed messages send the wrong signals to our troops. Mixed messages send the wrong signals to our allies.
It's one thing to be certain, but you can be certain and be wrong. It's another to be certain and be right, or be certain and be moving in the right direction, or be certain about a principle, and then learn new facts and take those new facts and put them to use in order to change and get your policy right.
I can apologize for the information that turned out to be wrong, but I can't sincerely, at least, apologize for removing Saddam.
I want to go home. Please, Mr. Blair. Don't leave me here.
American and Iraqi forces launched a major assault on the city, which is one of the major strongholds of the insurgency in Iraq. The fighting is believed to be continuing, and an Iraqi reporter on the scene says that people are cowering in their homes as tanks and warplanes pound the city.
There were no problems at all today. This was a near-perfect flight, as far as I could see. From my point of view, it was a perfect flight.
You know, on September 30th, 1971, the Washington Senators played their last game in Washington, D.C. September 29th, 2004, nearly 33 years to the day since they left, baseball is back in Washington, D.C.
And there is a week. George W. Bush and John Kerry square off in the first of three presidential debates in what some were calling the most important speech of his political career. British Prime Minister Tony Blair defends the decision to invade Iraq at his Labour Party's annual conference. British hostage in Iraq, Kenneth Bigley, pleads for his life on videotape. U.S. and Iraqi forces launch a major offensive against insurgents in Samarra. Spaceship One takes the first step toward a $10 million prize by successfully flying into space. And the nation's pastime returns to the nation's capital as Major League Baseball announces that the Montreal Expos will relocate to Washington, D.C. Jack, a little baseball news there, but the big news is all about debates and war in Iraq and the threads that weave between this week.
Yes, indeed. Four overnight polls said Kerry won, and the margin was between 10 and even 23%. However, one poll I saw showed it didn't affect the views of the voters who thought he won the debate. And I think he won because Bush really gave a very poor performance. Even his own people have admitted as much. Jim Fallows, who's watched him very carefully, says Bush can be, you know, craftily on message and smoothly on message and then messily on message. And last night it was the latter. He kept coming back to his, you know, flip-flopper, though he had a new way of putting it now. It was steady, you got to send the steady mixed messages and so on. And he just didn't seem to be fully engaged. And at several points, as somebody remarked on the media last night, he seemed to be sorry for himself. You know, he said it's hard to tell a woman, to talk to a woman who's lost a loved one. That's hard work for a president. Who's lost a loved one in the war.
Well, said it's hard. It's hard to build democracy, he said as well. It's hard to take a country that's in war and bring stability to it.
He used the phrase "hard work" 11 times in the and the debate seemed like it was hard work for him. On the positive side for Bush, though, I think he did score pretty effectively against Kerry. I don't know how it'll tell or not, by saying, "Look, if the war was a mistake, as you say, how can you lead it? If these troops are there on a mistake, how can you lead them? If it's a mistake, how can you inspire the Iraqis? And that's a logical trap that Kerry hadn't, I think, been ready for. He didn't seem to be able to have a good response to that. And I think that's an effective line to use against Kerry. Kerry, on the other hand, seemed masterly. I mean, he had all the facts. He was like a prosecutor laying it out. Bush didn't even answer his attacks. But on the other hand, look at the logic of Kerry's position. Mistake, catastrophic failure in judgment.
Colossal.
Colossal. Mm-hmm. Diversion from the war on terror. Tantamount, quotes Richard Clark, to FDR's invading Mexico after Pearl Harbor. A recruiting tool for Osama bin Laden all over the Middle East, our presence in Iraq.
Right,
well,
right.
What's the conclusion you'd come to there? Liquidate this commitment as fast as possible. Instead, no. We've got to make this work. We've got to have democracy in Iraq. We've got to have the elections. I can make it work. There's a logical glitch there. And I don't know, Kerry can't, I guess, go closer to the what seems like the dismal end of U.S. Policy there, which is stability. It may be the best we can hope for. And democracy and the investment that'll take and the time, that may be more than we should demand of ourselves or that we need to expend given the fact that we've got this war on terror all around us.
Right now, just stability looks like quite a shining high goal. But clearly, Kerry's camp has calculated, Jack, that they cannot say, let's get out of there. He believes either in principle or from the polls that he has to tell Americans he's going to stay and win.
I know, and it doesn't leave him with, it leaves him with, well, then how are you going to win? And then that gets back to his, well, I can bring in the allies, and nobody believes that. So, in fact, the allies, the French, just last week said, yes, we'll go to an international conference, and you know what we want to talk about? Withdrawing American forces.
Well, is that then where this gap comes from? Is that how he can win the debate, according to the polls, but not move the general poll standing?
That's what I think. I think when people start to sift through his position, they say, wait a minute, all he's saying is he'll do this better than Bush, and he's got this deus ex machina that's going to help us out.
The four-point plan.
But nobody, basically, the 3 points are Bush's, and the fourth one, the allies, just seems fantastical. So I think Kerry's going to have to put yet more distance between himself and Bush on this war, perhaps by talking realism. By saying we have to foreshorten our goals there because we do have this big war against Iraq. This is a diversion, and let's liquidate our commitment there at the level of stability.
Stability.
As you say, stability would be...
that sounds pretty good right now as American troops go into Samarra, and of course that fighting goes on. Well, not many weeks, but perhaps some significant continuing turns of the screw in this campaign before November 2nd. But what a start last night. Much more captivating than I think many people have been led to expect. Something to see. We'll wait for the next one. Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.